Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
It's 93 years. It's four generations. It's feel it. It's moving left to right in your headphones, across your radio dial, dancing off your computer screen. Ladies and gentlemen, it is the greatest storyteller in the business. The Tennessee Stud is back again for another edition here on your often imitated, never duplicated Studcast, the great Ron Fuller in episode 24. It's a zany night in Georgia, part three. And Tennessee Stud, it's great to be doing this again with you, my friend.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's my pleasure to be here. I have just been chomping at the bit, got the old pony saddled up. I'm ready to ride that boy today. Right off the top, wish everybody a Merry Christmas. This week, we're going to be celebrating a phenomenal day for all of us. And it's just a pleasure to be here and an honor. I'm ready to go when you are, my man.
Well, we're still allowed to say Merry Christmas here on the Studcast, Stud, and I love that about you. And those are great sentiments. And I tell you what, this is a great time of year to reflect on a lot of the blessings that we have in life. And getting to know you in 2017, my friend, has been a real blessing.
Well, same here, Tony. I mean, it's been wonderful. I feel honored that you're part of it, man. You are the show just along with me. And I love the way you connect with me, and I love the things that you have to say. Your questions are great. I think we do, hopefully, and I hope the fans out there, and I think they do, they support worldwide is just fabulous. And I'm ready to roll today. And what I want to do today, Tony, I thought I was finished with this mega event. And then I got to thinking about it, that I left out one of the most important things. And as a storyteller, that's very frustrating. I mean, I left out one of the key elements that went into drawing this crowd. And I want to go back. I want to finish a zany night in Georgia. It's been two episodes long. I want to finish this one properly. I want to put an ending to it, and I want to go back and clear up a couple of things that I missed, because I don't want to leave anything out. We're going to be doing these Super Studcasts soon, and those are going to be 2 hours long, and I'm going to prepare for them so that I leave nothing out, because as a storyteller, you don't want to lose that punchline, and I kind of lost a little bit of the punchline last week. So I want to start there, right back where we finished last week, and cover some things that the fans, I think, will really like. We're going to talk payoffs for the first time. We're going to talk the basics of the match. I said something about my father last week that I have to detract. And Rob, my brother, brought that up to me, and we discussed it over the last week. And he says, Ron, when you talked about Argentina Rocca and Sputnik's match, he said, you kind of let it appear that Dad had something really to do with that. And I was really mistaken about it. After we talked, he says, you know, Ron, there was a couple of other wrestlers that had talked to him since that event that had watched that match and Rocca leaving the ring like he did. And he says, it was not Dad. It was actually Monroe that decided he was going to bust Rocca's eye. And he said, I don't think Dad really asked him to do it. I think if he brought that concept to Dad, Dad might have said, well, you know, it's your match and you can do what you want to. It may have opened the door for Sputnik to punch Rocca in that match. But Dead did not, according to Rob, and I believe this after hearing it and thinking about it, really he wasn't behind that. And I think what happened here is that Sputnik was not going to make the payoff that Rocca was going to make. And I think that affected his mind. Wrestlers are, they're strange creatures, man. And they want to be treated fairly. And they especially want to be treated fairly when it comes to the pay. And in this case, and I guess most people like that, you want to be paid properly for what you do, the job you do. And in the case of Rocca being brought from Argentina for this one match, I think Dead probably had some type of guarantee that he paid him. He wasn't going to bring him in. A guy like that and a guy like Rocky Marciano, who's in this same event, he doesn't come to be paid on a percentage of the crowd. He wants to know, when I come, what am I going to get paid? And I think Rocca must have asked that question. I'm sure Marciano asked that question. And so the deal here is Sputnik knows that Rocca is a big star and that he's going to make more than I am tonight. I'm going to go out there and sweat and do my deal, and he's going to get more money. And I believe that that influenced Sputnik to making a bad decision and deciding that at some point in this match, I'm just going to bust his eye if I can. I'm going to smack him. Not a good thing.
Let me ask you this, as somebody who's worn both, and you've been in both, from a performer standpoint and also as a promoter, you've worn both hats, is what I was trying to say. How do the other boys find out what the other is making? Because certainly a promoter is not going to tell them that. They're not going to know that unless they start to talk. And as a promoter, how do you keep the boys from telling each other what each other's making, if there is even a way to do that? Because I know that's the one thing that can create real heat in a dressing room. If you're making more than me, especially if I perceive I'm just as much a star as you are. So how do you keep that from happening as a both a performer and then also as, more importantly, a promoter?
It's a critical element. It's a critical element to running a great promotion. And what you have to do is you cannot pay one guy more for a match than you pay another guy. Now, the wrestling business was always designed to pay. The entire group of wrestlers were paid a percentage of a house. Now, each promoter paid off a different percentage. Some guys might decide to pay more money. I'm going to pay 30% as an example. Some guys might say, well, I'm going to pay a gross of 25% of the house. But always the top guys, the main eventers, got paid more than the guys in the opening match. And usually there was a little scale that went up depending on your first match, second match, third match. Sometimes the first three matches got paid basically the same, but the latter matches would get more because that gave guys the incentive to work hard. That gave them incentive to be a star. They wanted to get to the top. When I started in Florida in 1970, I couldn't wait to get to the main event. I wanted not just to be up there because my name was going to be high on the card. I wanted to make that additional money too. I wanted to get there. And that's part of the incentive. And that's what made the sport great, is because the guys wanted to be the main event. They wanted to be the best. And you didn't want your guys, you never wanted to treat somebody unfairly because wrestlers talk. There was an old saying, you can send a telegram, send a telephone, or tell a wrestler. And that was the deal. Those guys talked to each other all the time. And payoffs was a big topic, obviously.
So those guys know, back in 1965, or in most dressing rooms, what each other are being paid. Now, you bring in an interloper like a boxer, like a Marciano, as your father did in this card in 1965, and we're calling this a zany night in Georgia, and there were a lot of things that went into one of the first super cards. And when we talked about the percentage of the crowd in that place versus the actual capacity, it was like 180% is what the place was at. I mean, it was a complete fire marshal nightmare. So everything about that night was atypical. How did your dad, though, do you feel like, keep the boys from resenting the fact that, hey, we rolled in this Marciano guy? Or is that something that's just been understood through time? I think about what Vince did with Mr. T in the WrestleManias when they were first getting those off the ground, and some of the other ways that people have used the Ali's of the world and some of these other guys, some of the other things that we've cited the last time that we got together here, Stud. Do the boys just understand that, or are they jealous of a Marciano back then?
I think if they're smart, you know, and I can think a lot of wrestlers are smarter than people give them credit for being. If they're smart, they realize that Marciano is going to draw a hell of a lot of people. And that big inflow, more people into that stadium that night, is going to make that payoff bigger for them. So Rocky Marciano being on the card is not a detraction. It should be the happy. They ought to be happy and excited that you've brought in this big monster talent and monster name to make this event huge so that our payoffs will be better. And, you know, speaking of that 180%, this week's picture is a picture of Ponce de Leon Baseball Stadium. It's a picture taken, obviously, when there's a baseball game on. But it'll be on the gallery on TennesseeStud.com. I encourage you to go and look at these galleries now because they're going to have something to do with this event. This week's number 24, you'll be able to see that stadium. And it's a pretty awesome sight. And if you can imagine, when you look at that picture of that stadium, there's baseball players on that field. That field is empty. Imagine that stadium looking like you're going to see in this picture, and then put another 13,000 people on that field. That is really what was remarkable about that event. So we're going to get to these payoffs, but I want to go back and pick up one part of this that I left out. And this, to me, is a critical part. Dad had built this event in a wonderful way. And then something happened 2 weeks before the match with Galento that I can't believe I left it out last week, but Dad got cut in a riot by a fan. It was in Marietta, Georgia. It was on Saturday night, 2 weeks before he was supposed to wrestle Galento. He went out to help the heels, were in trouble. And as you would do, and you've always supposed to do, you go out and help get them back alive into the dressing room. And he went out to help them, and someone took a knife behind him and cut his side, just below his rib cage, 55 stitches, two rows, two knife strokes down his right side. And the next morning on a Sunday, I got up. I remember going to the breakfast table, and he was kind of leaning a little bit, had a little whiteness in his face. And I was like, "Hey, you okay?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'm okay." And he wasn't going to tell me. Mom says, "Hey, he got cut last night." I said, "What do you mean cut?" "He got cut with a knife. He's got 55 stitches in his side." So now he's got a situation here. In 2 weeks, he's going to wrestle Galento in the biggest event in the history of the state. How's he going to do it? So I asked him, you know, I said, "Are you planning on—" He's booked. He's booked to wrestle that Friday night, the Friday night before the event in the auditorium in Atlanta. And I said, "Are you going to try to wrestle?" And he goes, "Of course I am. I'm going to wrestle." And I said, "You'll still have stitches in your side." And he says, "Well, that'll help me, hold me together. So maybe I won't bust them out, and I'll be well by the Galento night." So he goes down to the ring on the Friday night prior to wrestling Galento. That auditorium in Atlanta has a huge stage in on the back part of it. And everybody, wrestlers would go out on that stage and watch matches. It wasn't uncommon, but they would usually stand kind of in the dark so that they couldn't be well seen. I remember that night, I don't remember who Dad wrestled, but I was very concerned for him. And everybody knew. They ran an article in the paper that Buddy Fuller was cut by a fan. And so when he went to the ring, he taped up his side so that he could protect the stitches that were there and he could protect himself a little bit. And I noticed that when he got in the ring and they introduced him, that Mario Galento came right down to the stairs that goes down onto the arena floor. It stood in the middle of the stairs to watch the match. I'd never seen that before. Nobody had ever done that before as long as I'd seen the matches. You never went out. No wrestler went there. He'd stay in the background. Galento wanted the crowd to see him stand there. So he stood there and watched the match. Match came close to the end, and Dad was about to beat the guy that he was wrestling, and Galento came to the ring. He didn't come walking to the ring because he would have had fans try to stop him. They watched him. They knew he was maybe going to come, and he did. He ran from the distance. I would say that it's probably maybe 30 yards from the stairs to the ring. And he ran that 30 yards, slid into the ring on his stomach, and attacked Dad from behind. Got him down and stomped him in the side, tore off his tape, busted some of his stitches out so that the blood was running down his side. Then a couple of other guys came to the ring. They stopped the whole deal. They helped Dad back. Now, that happened 7 days prior to this huge event. And I have a feeling, you know, because when you see these pictures, been running these pictures on the gallery, and I've gotten such tremendous response from the pictures of Glento after the match, in which he has got the black eyes and holes in his head and places that he got sewn up and some of them he didn't sew up. He just looks horrible. People have just, the comments are just like, wow, I've never seen anybody look like that. He's been in a car wreck. I mean, he wasn't in a wrestling match. He must have been in a car wreck. So on this last one, on part two, I put a photo of my dad after this match. He is so bloody, and we talked about it. He's got a concussion. And people looked at that picture and have made the comments to me that, Ron, I see his eyes. You're right. And I see him holding him up. I wouldn't have noticed that if you hadn't said it. So these guys got animosity. There's not just a wrestling match here. It's not just going to, we're going to go out there and do what everybody else does. They're going to go out there and fight. That's what happened in Mobile in 1958 when they just beat each other to pieces. And they're going to go out there and do that again in Atlanta. And so Mario just goes down and instigates this into a bigger event. He injures Dad on purpose, and the crowd sees it, and it just inflames him. I mean, he has a hard time. There must have been 10 police that realized that he's not going to get out of that ring if we don't go. So they went down to the ring. He got in the middle of them, and they got him back to the dressing room. Now, that just kind of set the tone for the rest of the night. I wanted to tell people that because that was an important part of the buildup for this thing to be such a monumental event as it was.
Couple follow-up questions for you. First of all, in your career, have you ever been cut by a fan?
Yes, I was cut in Panama City in 1979, and I was in a tag match with David Schultz, and we were wrestling against Robert Gibson, part of the Rock and Roll Express, and his brother Ricky Gibson, and I was cut in the ring. I was inside the ring, and I reached out and grabbed Ricky Gibson, who the crowd had pulled out of the ring so that I couldn't get to him, and he was bleeding, and I reached and grabbed him by the hair to pull him in, and a guy cut me across my forearm, and I just pulled him on in and continued with the match. Later on that match, on the way out, someone hit me with a chair from behind. I had stitches in my arm and my head that night. Crowds could be violent back in those days because they believed.
Yep.
And it was dangerous. Even if you were a clean wrestler, it was dangerous. If you were a heel, it was really, really dangerous. And you had to be on your toes and watch your back. And you wanted to get that. It was necessary. You wanted to get that. And that's what Glento went to the ring for. He knew that they know he's hurt. And if I go down there and I can stomp him around a little bit, tear that tape off, let them see me bust some stitches, they're going to go, wow, that dirty son of a gun. And there'll be more people show up come the following Friday night. So I just wanted to add that to it. I wish I had done it last week because it would have built the ending and what happened during the night a little more. I got it in now, and I want to go back. Let's talk a little bit about the actual crowd. We know that there's 38,000 people there, and ringside seats were probably, now I don't have the exact number because I haven't seen anything that tells me. I would guess ringside was $5, and general admission was probably $3 for adults and maybe $2 for children. We're talking 1965. So you're not going to have these big prices like they have for today's events. It's a small price, but you've got 38,000 people. If you had an average of $3 per ticket, and you have 38,000 people at $3 a ticket, I did the math on this part of it, and you may can look up, Tony. I know you're going to be looking up anyway, what the value was of a dollar in 1965 as to what it's worth in today's time. But that 38,000 people times $3 a ticket comes out to be more than $400,000 gross gate in 1965. That is just an astronomical amount of money compared to today's time. What its value is just got to be so much larger. It's a scary number. I've never even thought about being able to draw that kind of crowd, even in my time in the 70s and 80s, of one of those monster houses, because the prices were so low, you had to have a tremendous crowd, a lot of darn people there to get that type of.
So here's your number. If you're saying $3 in 1965, which is what we're going to say an average ticket was, to get in, $3.65 is $23.21. So let's just say $23. We'll round it off. So you're talking about 7-1. What was the total gate?
38,000. 38,000 people.
38,000 people at $3 a head. That's a huge gate by today's standards.
So it would probably be, you're talking about, it would probably be over 3 million. By today's standards, that house would have been 3 million plus for, that's live event. That's not pay-per-view.
Yeah.
That's not other income parts. That's the live event. That is an astronomical amount of money. So, you know, what he did there, you know, the reason I bring this up is I want people to grasp what an event this was. A magnitude of this event is just really staggering. So I'm going to take it and break it down further. Yeah, I had a lot of people contact me on social media, and they've asked me, you know, questions about payoffs. How do you make payoffs, and how much did guys make? How much did wrestlers make, and things like that. So I'm going to take this event and try to make a payoff on this event. The gross house was $400,000 or a little bit more. I would have paid at least $100,000. And out of that $100,000, I would have taken those four opening matches, which would have been three singles and a tag. I would have paid all of those matches the same, probably $2,000. $2,000 in 1965 is a tremendous amount of money. I think it's probably enough. If people want to go back and check it, I think you could buy a brand new Cadillac for $2,000 in 1965 off the showroom floor somewhere. That kind of money you made in one night. The referees, there's two referees. Those referees make $1,000, I'd say. Those guys are the happiest campers you ever saw. It's a tremendous amount of money. The average person probably went home in 1965 working a 40-hour week at a normal job with probably $75. I don't know how that figure, but I know that that's a big amount of money. Now, as you go up the card, you're going to start paying guys a little bit more. Your next match is Rocca and Monroe. I got a feeling Rocca made, he got a guarantee, and I would think you could afford it easily to pay him that $6,000. I don't know what Dad probably talked to him about. He's talking to a guy in Argentina. He's got to fly from Argentina there. Dad's got to pay that trans. So I think Rocca would have got $6,000, and Spuding Monroe would have probably got $4,000 for that one night. Fabulous amount of money. Guys had to go home smiling like crazy when they make that kind of payoff. The tag match that was on right before Dad and the main event, you've got the Von Brauners, you've got Ray Gunkel, you got Lester Welch, and you have a manager named Saul Weingraub. I think those guys probably were paid $7,000 each. And that would have been, to get to these totals that we're going to come up with, that's probably in that figure. And you would have paid Saul, the manager, the same money as if he'd been in the ring. And that's pretty much customary. People probably wonder, well, if he's a manager, how much does the manager make? Usually the manager, if he's a good manager and he's drawing some of that money with his interviews and with what he does out there and around the ring, he works. It's like prime example is Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette was such a spectacular manager. I think sometimes he earned more money than the wrestlers that were actually in the ring. You know, you pay them what the wrestler makes, and that's customary. That's what they expect. Now you get to the main event. You've got some considerable amount of cash left over here. I have a feeling that Rocky Marciano probably made a $15,000 guaranteed payoff. That is, I don't know, you said what's about seven times, eight times that amount. That's equivalent to $120,000 in one night for one event. Spectacular amount of money, just a phenomenal amount of money. And I figure Dad and Monroe, probably Dad got paid because I always paid myself when I own my own promotions. because if I went to the ring and wrestled, I felt I deserved that. And then whatever was profit there, it came above that. That was the, just the gravy, is so to speak. So I would think they probably got paid as much as $10,000 each. It's a phenomenal night in the terms of money that those guys made. Phenomenal night in the terms of the gross house that was there. Just a spectacular evening. It's mind-boggling to me that he did this not just one time in his life. He did this type of event four times in 7 years. Never been done before, nor ever been done since, I don't believe. It's really a credit to my dad. When I finished my grandfather in episode 5, we sat and talked a little bit about what he did in his lifetime. And I think we came up with a figure. He had 58 million people that came to watch wrestling during his lifetime, during his career as a promoter. And my dad has just done something that topped Roy. What Roy did is unbelievable. Training the First Bear, the tag team wrestling, inventing things and concepts and matches and athletic commissions and all the things that Roy did. I think my dad may have topped him with what he was able to do in his lifetime. Just amazing what happened there with that event.
Couple notes for you. One, 1965, the average wage in America, average worker took home annually $4,658. So again, you talk about the payouts that night to these guys. What did you ascertain one more time, if you were to guess, Marciano's payout was?
15. It was four times what the average guy made in an entire year. He made in one night. That's just it. It really kind of gives you the picture of what that night was all about. And then I kind of want to finish with my dad here and get this thing put into real perspective here with just a few comments. He took four events starting in 1958. He had four mega events in the next 7 years that he promoted wrestling. And those four events happened in four different states. They didn't all happen in the same city, in the same market, the same territory. Four different territories, four different states. He set records, all-time attendance records that have still never been broken in all four of those states. And he did it in seven-year time. In 1958, in Mobile, Alabama, 40,000 people in Ladd Stadium, Mobile, Alabama. In Memphis, in 1968, he had 27,000 people in Russ Wood Park, baseball stadium similar to Ponce de Leon, probably of comparable size. That's one of those events that I was there, watched them pull a Cadillac out in the middle of center field and watched the end of the match where Billy Wicks won the car, busted eyes, both eyes hardwayed, got out of the ring, went out, sat down in the car, and planned on probably driving it out of that stadium. They had opened the center field gate so that he could go out into Union Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee, and couldn't do it because the crowd came like, it was like watching one of those basketball games in which you win at the last second and the floor is filled. It reminds me of the game in which Auburn beat Alabama, in which Alabama tried to kick the field goal and the Auburn player caught the kick and ran it back for the touchdown, and the field was totally covered. I had never seen that in football. You couldn't see any of the field because the stands came to the field. And that's what happened in Russ Wood Park in Memphis, Tennessee. The people in the stands came over those rails and they mobbed that field. They covered his Cadillac up and he couldn't drive it out. And I'm a 12-year-old boy and I'm scared to get out there on the field. I'm sitting way up high in the stands and everybody is running like a mob down to the field. And I watched those people on that field pick up that Cadillac and carry it out of that baseball stadium and set it down on Union Avenue out there. Those things, I tell you what, Tony, those things I can't take out of my mind. It's a picture in my mind forever, and I wish fans could see it. I had a few people comment on this 38,000 people that during the course of this week, and they said, I can't imagine. I can't imagine what it looked like. And I'm sitting there in that field that night up in the press box, and I have the most fabulous view of anybody in the entire building and the entire structure. And that sight to me will never leave my mind. It was just phenomenal. So he does it in Mobile at 40,000. That's half a football stadium, totally full. It's a ring sitting on the field and thousands of ringsiders sitting in chairs, and then thousands of others standing behind those ringsiders. And same thing, Russwood Park. The ring on the field, ringside seats around it, people standing behind it. It happened again in Arizona in 1962, 26,000. Baseball stadium in Phoenix, same type of thing where you've got the stands are packed, the ringside is packed, the overflow, the standing room only crowd, they're stuck with going out there and standing on the field. Sometimes maybe 40, 50 deep. I don't know how you see the ring and that you can even see anything from there, but they're willing to do it because they want to be a part of that event. They just want to say, I was there. So they does it then in Phoenix, and then he comes here to Atlanta in 1965 and does it with 38,000, 180% of capacity that we've talked about, that monstrous crowd again. So what he accomplishes that really strikes me is he doesn't have a national program like Vince does. He has no national televisions. He has a small channel in Atlanta, Georgia. He advertises on some of his exterior channels, obviously in Augusta, Savannah, Macon, Columbus. The larger cities in Georgia have television programs. He promotes it there as well. But he draws this mega crowd into this beautiful baseball stadium. And just really, it's amazing that you can do that. A person can do that without a national television, and he can do it. And within a 7-year period of time, he's going to do it in 4 cities, 4 territories, 4 different states, and no one to this day and time, and these are back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, have ever broken those records. They will never touch those records, I don't believe, unless Vince has a mega event in a dome somewhere there. That might break it, but Vince will use the entire world as his promotion. He can promote to the entire world, and he'll have a hard time doing it. And Dad did it with just basically the population of Georgia.
What would you say the furthest person back in those days would have come for an event like that? I mean, you think about how you would get it, get word out, and you might have some hardcores that would travel regionally, you know, to go see a show. What would you think but you didn't have interstate system back then. What would be the furthest you think somebody would come?
I don't think it would be that far, to be quite honest with you, because they have to know about it. And there's no social media. There's no internet. There's no way to advertise. There's no national program. So you're limited to the power of your television towers, your television station's towers, as to how far out their signal goes. And beyond that signal, you've got, let's just take as an example, North Carolina. Let's take that Jim Crockett sits there in Charlotte, and his closest television may be, it's probably somewhere in South Carolina, maybe Columbia, South Carolina, and that's his closest station. That signal is going to just about fade out when you get into Georgia, and Georgia's signal is going to fade out when you get into South Carolina. That Georgia signal is going to fade out when you get into Tennessee. It's going to fade out in Alabama. It's going to fade out in Florida. You won't have it. So he's drawing this mega crowd basically from people that are in Georgia. And I don't think they come from far away because they don't know about it. I think they would have come. I think there was a lot of people, for instance, there were people in Mobile that had seen this first match with him and Galento. There was such a violent match that had to be stopped after 5 minutes. And those people, had they known about it, I think they'd have gotten a car and they'd have driven to Atlanta to see that. But I don't think a lot of people knew about it, and they didn't have any way to reach a large number of people. And he's drawing this huge crowd with a small scope so far as being able to promote it.
What's incredible about your dad, too, is that he had just the audacity to continue to do that. I mean, you would think after one of those shows, you'd go, man, I was really fortunate to pull that off. We got away with something tonight. Seemed like your dad just kept upping the ante and pushing it and pushing it. Was that just his nature?
Dad wanted to do this. He wanted to break these all-time records. And I've mentioned it before. Once this happens for him, he loses interest. He's done it. He's accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. And everything after that is small potatoes to him. And he usually left. That's why he left Mobile pretty much right after that 1958 event, went to Memphis. He left Memphis almost immediately after the huge event in Russwood Park. He went to Arizona, drew the big crowd, and within 2 months, we were living back in Mississippi as farmers. He left wrestling entirely. And in this match in Georgia, he stays in Georgia. He continues to promote, but he has, I think, accomplished his goal. He wants one of these mega crowds so that he can hang his hat on that and say, I did it. One other thing before I close out entirely, I want people to get a feel for what guys gave back in those days. When you see those pictures of Mario Galento and you see the picture on number 23, episode 23 with my dad after this match in Atlanta, I don't care if you're not a wrestling fan. When you see that, you want to just go, wow, I can't believe guys did that to themselves. And that's what they did. I mean, they gave their heart. They gave their soul. And they certainly gave their blood. It was just, you know, my hat's off to him. I hate to say it. You know, maybe I'm tooting my dad's horn, but I can't help it because I know these numbers are spectacular. And I've never told these stories. It's really funny. What we do here, and we've talked about it a lot of times, is this is unknown. We're talking about an event that's practically unknown. If we weren't talking about this event today, Tony, and I wasn't doing these stud casts, there'd probably be very few people that know my dad accomplished this. And that's what I'm doing these stud casts. I want to just tell the story. I want my family to get the recognition they deserve. That's what I'm hoping to accomplish here. Long run, long term, it pleasures me to be able to do these type of stories and to talk about these type of events.
Not a week goes by, Stud, where somebody doesn't stop me in the community where I live here in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I do and have been blessed for a quarter century to do radio, but not a week goes by where someone doesn't stop me somewhere and say, hey, really enjoy the stud cast because Ron's giving me stuff. And these are people that fashion themselves as people that love the history of wrestling and really drawn to history and period pieces and those sorts of things. You're bringing stuff here. You're unearthing stuff that, I mean, who's going to know about that? Who's going to know the inside on that card and the way in three episodes now that you've completely unpacked that, Stud? It's just great stuff, man.
It's what I want to do this for. It's why I started doing these stud casts. It's not so much for me. It's for my family. I want them to know about Roy. I want them to know about Herb. I want them to know about Lester. I want them to know about Dad. I want them to know about the Goldens and the Fields. And I want my family, the largest wrestling family ever on the planet, to have the recognition they deserve. And this has given me an opportunity to do it. I'm just loving it.
Stub, when we come back on the other side, what we're going to do is we're going to get to some questions from the listeners. And then I know you have a couple other things that you want to get into as well. What I want to know from you, Stud, is you keep talking about these super stud casts. Man, when are we going to do that? Because I can't wait to sit down and do a couple hour one of these where you just take a subject and just take it apart.
Oh, we're going to do it. In fact, last week, doing our little donut there, that's what I call it. We gave it the opportunity to our boy Dave to really get the first mention of it, really kind of get the message out there a little bit. And when we come back, I think we had a couple of questions here. And then I really want to talk about this super stud cast, the whole concept. Let's break that down as soon as we can get our boy Dave to do his thing.
Yeah, so how about that if we turn it over to our boy Dave? As I remind you, you're listening to episode 24. It's Zany Night in Georgia, part 3. If you would like to get up with the Tennessee Stud during our timeout, I'd encourage you to do that at Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud, all spelled out. The website for Ron Fuller is tnstud.com. You're encouraged to check out the stud store there at the website. If you would like to interact with the Stud on Twitter or Instagram, Ron Fuller Welch. In the meantime, we'll come back. We'll get to some questions that you have and a whole lot more. You never know what's going to happen on the Studcast. But I'll tell you one thing. You keep it right there. Stick around and find out as we continue on the other side after this.
Your attention, Studcast listeners. The Tennessee Stud is giving all of his fans, including me, a Christmas present that will be delivered on Sunday, January 14th, 2018. That present will be a two-hour Super Studcast with more laughs and emotion from the Stud than ever before. One of Rod's all-time favorite wrestlers and close personal friends will be the focus and only topic for this historic first-ever event. The Stud has now become known as one of the best storytellers on earth, and talking about one of his favorite people, Andre the Giant, will allow him to take his skills to another level. We've all experienced what the Stud can do behind the microphone, but this two-hour extravaganza will leave you with an entirely new perspective and appreciation for Andre the Giant, one of the most loved and admired men to ever walk the planet. This Super Studcast can only be accessed in two ways. On Sunday, January 14th, 2018, at 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time, or anytime thereafter, go to the website at tnstud.com. That's tnstud.com. And click on Super Studcast and follow the instructions. Or go to patreon.com/studcast and follow the instructions there. That's either tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And follow the instructions to get the only Super Studcast available. They will never be available on YouTube or anywhere else on the internet. So make a note of how to get this great event. Saddle up and take the ride of a lifetime with the Tennessee Stud and Andre the Giant. The first ever Super Studcast featuring Andre the Giant is coming soon. You're listening to Studcast number 24. And now back with more, it's Tony Basilio and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud.
And just like that, ladies and gentlemen, back with you, Tony Basilio, along with your Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Episode 24, that is hard to believe. That's 6 months. That's a half a year of Studcast for those of you keeping score at home. And Ron, they say time flies. You're having fun, man. We are in episode 24 already, brother.
Oh, I know it. And I love it. And the wonderful part about this, Tony, is we're just beginning the journey. I mean, I keep saying the satellite horse and take the ride with me. We haven't gotten to me yet. We haven't gotten to Rob yet. We haven't gotten to Jimmy yet. The third generation has yet to put on the tights. And we're going to get to that. We're going to talk Southeastern wrestling and Continental wrestling. And we're going to talk USA wrestling. We're going to talk wrestling in Florida and wrestling in Japan and wrestling in Australia. We've got so many good things to talk about in the future here. And I'm just excited to be here and have the opportunity to lay it out there for them. I think you got some questions for me. We didn't do any questions during these Zany Night in Georgia programs because I wanted to keep the content basically on that event. Let's catch back up with a couple of questions.
And why don't we do that? Kevin Carter out of Bristol, Virginia has a real eye-opening question. He asks the following. You talked about a blind promoter. Have you ever wrestled a deaf wrestler? And if so, how does a match get called when one guy can't hear?
That's a good one. The blind promoter he's talking about is Leroy McGurk in Oklahoma. Leroy, he could sense by hearing the crowd how a guy was getting over. He ran his business without having eyes. It was amazing. And he actually ran a tremendous wrestling territory, did fabulous business. Some of the best came out of there. Jack Briscoe came out of there. Danny Hodge came out of there. Guys that were immortals. I mean, just fabulous talents. So, yes. And the answer to his question is, yes, I have wrestled a deaf guy. And his name was Salento Rodriguez. And I wrestled him in 1970 in my first year that I started. And he had been deaf since birth. And he signed language. Salento had a way of communicating without being able to speak. He spoke some, but because he had no way to hear, he had a very odd way of communicating. But it made no difference. It was like when you went in the ring with him, he knew his shortcomings. He knew that he could not communicate in the ring, and he made it easy to do. Now, I've actually encountered this because I've wrestled in other countries. When you go to Japan, you might as well be deaf yourself because you don't know what's going to happen. You wrestle a Japanese guy, and they're in a habit of talking to each other, and they call spots or whatever it is, and you can hear them, and you know what's about to happen. But it's pretty darn frightening sometimes when a guy backs you in the rope, and he grabs you by the arm, and he says, chitabatabata, and he shoots you across the ring into the ropes. Now, what are you going to get? You don't know. It's very difficult to give your body up and really put your greatest effort in it because you have to be a little hesitant about, is he going to backdrop me? Is he going to drop kick me? Is he going to kick me in the face with a karate kick? You don't know what you're going to get. So it's difficult to wrestle someone you can't communicate with, obviously.
So that's an interesting point you just brought up, and I've never even thought about that. Speaking of when you go on these international tours, and guys do, and of course there are American wrestlers that are huge over in Japan, and that's been a phenomenon forever, is the Japanese culture, for whatever reason, has a fascination with American pop culture, and they always have, the music, wrestling, across the board. So how do you stud when you're doing that? How do you get by if you're wrestling somebody that speaks no English at all and they're calling a spot? What do?
You wing it. And when you're going to do something to him, there's no need in you saying, you know, what you're going to expect to drop kick or whatever it may be. You just wing it. You shoot him in there and you do what you want to him. He's got to expect that too. You know, some of Japan's greatest stars were Americans. They weren't the Japanese for All Japan Wrestling. It was the Funks, Terry and Dory Funk Jr. It was Hanson and Brody. You know, they were the monster stars. When you went someplace into an airport or you got on a train with them or you were going on a ferry, those guys were stars. I mean, they just flocked to them. They would just, you'd get on the train cars and you'd sit there and you'd have to pull the curtains closed because they would put their faces right up against the glass and press their bodies 10 deep and they'd be pointing and talking to themselves. It's just amazing what wrestling was in Japan and how the Americans were over. And they knew you when you came. You'd never been there. When you got off the train or you got off the airplane, they were, "Ron Fuller, Ron Fuller." They know who you are. I was like amazed with that part of it.
Who's your favorite Japanese worker, Ron, that you had a chance to work with?
I had one that came and spent a lot of time with me wrestling at Continental and Southeastern with me in Pensacola area. And he actually went back and trained a lot of those Japanese guys with Saito. He was a monster talent. I loved him, and he was a shooter. He knew how to do it, and he could do whatever he needed to do. He had a shinanamaki, he used to call it. It was a type of sleeper hold that I'd never seen before that he used to use, and I really loved his talent. Until just fairly recently, I think he died fairly recently, but he was training Japanese wrestlers for All Japan for many, many years, and a great, great talent.
It's amazing stuff. Let's go to our next question. And again, we want to thank Kevin Carter, Bristol, Virginia, for asking that question, something I never would have thought of. Question two today on your studcast comes from Jesse Freeman of Kingsport, Tennessee. Do you think there could ever be a time when the territory system could make a comeback? It seems we have something close with independent organizations out there today. Your thoughts, stud?
That's a great question there. And it's about the future of the sport. It's about the past of the sport. I could take 30 minutes to answer that question. I don't think we have that kind of time. So I'm going to be fairly brief with this. But what Vince has done to wrestling, he has changed the sport, and not in a good way, in my opinion. His training has changed the sport. Back in the day when I was trained, back in the day my dad was trained, you wrestle for the crowd, not for what the writer tells you that your match is going to be. You went to the ring every night. You knew what was expected of you, and what was expected of you was to get those people's attention and to get them involved and personally into that match. They don't do that anymore. Now the style is totally different. You worked really stiff back in those days as compared to what they do now, and you worked it. So if you were going to go back and try to build a territory, in my opinion, you'd have to start with how you train the wrestlers from the ground up. You would have to teach them how to not go out there and do these false finishes where they've got the guy, they give him a big monster bump and he kicks out. They give him another big bump and he kicks out, and another one and he kicks out. I mean, it's not all about those false finishes that I call them, where the people think that should be it, and it isn't it. It was about it being it. And when you did your move, it was the end of the match, and no one else did your move. Now, when you watch wrestling today, you'll see them all do the same moves. They'll do other guys' finishes, and then a guy will kick out of that. So you didn't see that back in the day. I think in order for it to ever come back, you'd have to do that. A lot of independents, let's mention that part of it. There are a lot of independent wrestling organizations out there, but think about it. Vince has a great company that he has developed, and he has great trainers. He trains his people a long time before they put him in the ring. When you go to these independent matches, and I haven't been to a lot of them, but I have been to some in which I sign autographs and I make an appearance there. I don't wrestle, obviously, but I watch. And what I see is guys that shouldn't be in the ring. They're not ready to be there. And when you start putting guys in the ring that aren't ready to be there, your product suffers big time. You can't draw money with those kind of matches. So the answer to that question, I think maybe it's possible, because I see what's happening with WWE. Their crowds are diminishing. Somewhere, someday, there's going to be something that comes along that's going to capture their attention, that's going to maybe bring it back. My best guess is, if that were going to happen, it's going to come from New Japan. It will come from New Japan Wrestling. And if they come to America, I think they give Vince a real run for his money, because they have a 1980s product, and Vince has got his own entertainment product.
The Tennessee Stud has spoken. Stud, from those two questions, choose me a winner of the autographed photo that the Stud sends out weekly. What do you think?
About the deaf guy. That's a really interesting question. I wouldn't have thought of that one myself. I mean, and if I hadn't mentioned Leroy McGurk, he might not have thought of it either, but that's a great question. Both questions are great questions, as a matter of fact. But I'm going to take the first gentleman's question. I think that'd be the winner for today.
Yeah, I'm telling you, that's an incredible question that gentleman asked. In fact, I'm going to grapple with that, and I'm going to go back and watch some of those international matches now and just think about, if you're not wrestling somebody bilingual, how in the world do you navigate your way through that? Not to mention the deaf wrestler that you were talking about, some of the other guys who have not had the ability to hear through the years, who have still become quality professional wrestlers. Stud, I know in our remaining moment or so, you had a couple house cleaning issues you wanted to get to.
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to thank the patrons, the people that have donated. That's a wonderful thing, and I thank them so much. And I want to do more for the fans. I'm getting those people that say, please, Stud, give us a two-hour program. And I want to do that, and I'm going to do that. The first one is going to be on Sunday, January 14th, and I'm going to do a two-hour every month on the second Sunday of every month. It will be called the Super Studcast. It will be 2 hours long. It will be on one topic, one wrestler, one event, one country. I won't be here, there, and everywhere. And I've created myself a list. I've already started working on a list of these super stud casts. So what I can actually do to get 2 hours out of and to make them wonderful. And I know my first one, I decided it was easy for me to pick the very first one, because I love this guy. He is one of my all-time favorite people that I've ever met in my life. He was like a brother to me after 16 years of knowing him, and that's the big man himself, Andre the Giant. I have the most wonderful stories of Andre the Giant. I have never spoken about Andre the Giant, hardly at all. I have avoided talking about Andre because he's almost sacred to me. He's a wonderful, wonderful character and a wonderful person. And that's my first studcast. It's going to be Andre the Giant. It's going to be 2 hours of stories that I know. People say I'm a great storyteller. If they say I'm a great storyteller, if you don't listen to this one, you've never heard the Stud tell a story, because Andre's stories are through the roof. They are just phenomenal because of who he is and what he was and how he looked. He's a unique individual on the face of the earth, and that's Super Studcast number one. It's going to go down on January Sunday, January 14th. And I'm going to follow that with great Studcast. I can guarantee you, if you like the Studcast we do here, these Super Studcasts are for you for sure. It's something you're going to be able to tell your friends about. I can't wait. We haven't recorded it, Tony. And when we do, you talk about being excited. I would be tremendously excited to talk about my friend, my associate, my confidant, one of my favorite people on earth, Andre the Giant.
When you say his name, Stud, and whenever I hear Andre the Giant's name, see, I grew up in WWF territory with the young Andre the Giant. And whenever I think about him, I just smile, man. Andre the Giant, you think about how much joy and how many people that guy brought joy to throughout his career.
And he brought joy not just to the fans. He brought joy to the wrestlers. Every wrestler that ever encountered Andre loved him. He was a unique and wonderful individual, a sad individual who had a tough life, who was doing this horrible travel schedule. And I felt sorry for him at times, and I loved him. I brought him in my home. I fed him. He slept in my bed. I got Andre stories. I don't want to go any further. If you want a Super Studcast, you want 2 hours, we're going to give it to him, Tony. And I don't think there'll be a two-hour program anywhere in podcast land out there that will be able to stand up to it.
Stud, anything else you want to add on the way out here? And it's been great spending another week with you here on the Studcast.
Merry Christmas. That's about it. And Merry Christmas to everybody out there. And I hope we recognize and realize and give the credit to who we should be for this event. And that's, you know, he blesses us all. That's part of it. It's a blessed part of it all. To everybody, Merry Christmas from the old Tennessee Stud, and let's saddle up again next week, and we're going to do a little basketball next week. We might go back and do a little basketball from my high school days, and we're telling the story, so that's kind of where we're headed next week, and we're going to put some wrestling in there too, start talking about me a little bit more than I have been able to up to now.
Wrestling and hoops in the next Studcast. That's going to about wrap it up here for episode 24, as we went to that zany night in Georgia, part 3. It's 93 years. It's 4 generations. On the way out, I want to remind you, my name is Tony Basilio. You can find me at TonyBasilio.com or on Twitter at Tony Basilio. You can find Ron Fuller, if you want to interact with him, on Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud, spelled out. The website, and I want to encourage you to check out the Stud Store, and also perhaps more about our upcoming specialty shows, the Super Studcast, at tnstud.com. Ron Fuller Welch on Twitter and Instagram. Again, Ron Fuller Welch on Twitter and Instagram. Until we meet again in the Studcast sky, tell them about it, David.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For inquiries about vocal work, send an email to davidsummersproductions@gmail.com.